I'm so grateful to Peter Alagona for joining the flock on our bonus segment this week, because I loved his interview. And if you couldn't tell from the interview, I also loved his book, The Accidental Ecosystem. And as I mentioned at the end of the interview, there were so many things we didn't get into. But one of the things I really wanted to get into was just talking about coyotes, because I hate to keep referring to when I was a kid, but like I said, it was a long time ago. I have a lot of experience here. And you never heard about coyotes. Like, coyotes have kind of taken over, haven't they? They are succeeding really, really well with humans. Can you talk about like their role in an urban ecosystem?
Absolutely. And I just want to recommend actually another book too, for those who are interested in this topic, a book called Coyote America by a friend and colleague of mine named Dan Flores. Great author. And a great book about the history of coyotes in North America. You know, the crazy thing about the coyote is it is one of the most persecuted wildlife species, certainly in American history, but maybe even in global history. I mean, we have just hammered coyotes over the last, 150 years or so by poisoning them, shooting them, trapping them, and doing a lot of other things to them, frankly, that are even much more sadistic and unnecessary to punish them for their perceived transgressions. Coyotes responded to that by basically taking over the continent.
Yeah.
Their native range is in the Great Plains in American Southwest. That's where they lived, going back 200 or 300 years ago. But over the last, a couple centuries, they've expanded. They now live all across North America. They live in every U.S. state except Hawaii. They've expanded south into Central America, into tropical forests. And they show up in places now where they were never seen before. The 1980s and 1990s, the 1990s, they showed up for the first time in New York. Decades earlier, they showed up in Chicago. There are now thousands of them there. And so I think that the story of coyotes is one of, on the one hand, really cruel and unnecessary violence against animals, not just management, but real violence. And on the other hand, a story of just remarkable resilience and adaptability. I mean, coyote, if you don't respect coyotes, there's something wrong with you, because they've done something that is truly remarkable, and they've really beat us at our own game. And so I think that coyotes stand to me as one of the creatures that is really the flagship wildlife species of an urban environment in many ways. They really cause, even though they're blamed for a lot of things, they cause very few problems. They're blamed for a lot of livestock depredations. Oftentimes it's actually feral dogs that do it.
I have the answer to that. We don't really need to have livestock anymore. So it's problem solved. All right, go on.
Coyotes be deterred with some basic measures oftentimes. And so I just think that, they're a species that we should really change our attitude toward, that we should see as in a way kind of an icon of resilience. In a time of change and over a period that for them, for many individual animals, has been considered has been experienced as a time of tremendous violence and hardship. But overall, they've managed to basically conquer the continent, and I really admire them for that.
No, you have to. They're just extraordinary animals. And they're basically dogs. Like, why we are so hostile to these animals who are basically so similar in so many ways to the animals we love the most is just... It's a story of triumph that they have taken over the continent, but the amount of suffering we have imposed upon them in their efforts to do that is just, it's so saddening.
Unfortunately, media coverage of species like coyotes often misrepresents the reality of what they do and how they live and how people live with them on the ground. If a coyote, for example, takes somebody's cat, let's say, this is something that happens sometimes. It's reported in the media, it's reported as a quote-unquote attack. This kind of thing happens from time to time, certainly. What often doesn't get reported is two things. One is the fact that these episodes are actually quite rare compared to the frequency of coyotes coming into contact with people and also their domesticated animals. And so coyotes actually, I think, judging from the data, the information that I see out there, actually show a surprising amount of restraint based on, what they're being presented with in human-dominated environments. That's one thing. And then the second thing that often doesn't get reported in the media around these incidents is that whenever an incident does occur, there's almost always been a series of episodes or a series of incidents that have led up to that. So when a coyote takes someone's cat, it turns out, the story is printed, the reporter moves on, but then a couple of weeks later, if you do the research, if you follow up on it, what you find is that the person's next door neighbor had been feeding that coyote with cat food for the past 6 months or something like that. And so I think that we really need to be careful in the way that we understand the media reports about these animals and the way in which the sensationalized view of these creatures often really misrepresents the reality of their daily lives, of what they do, of the risks they present, and of living with them. And that's something really important to recognize in terms of just what's going on, but also how we can improve the situation and even reduce risks further in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, coyotes really need a better PR company. They're even, you know, they're kind of seen, I don't think people know a lot about them. They're kind of seen as like, well, kind of like wolves, but not as good, not as cool. They're just, I guess, maybe Wile E. Coyote has given them a bad name all these years. I don't know, but why people do not love coyotes is just a mystery. They're just extraordinary animals.
I got to say, and I don't want to use this as an answer for everything, but settler colonialism, white supremacy, these sorts of things are actually embedded in a lot of these stories. So the idea of ridding the landscape of animals like coyotes and wolves and bears, and also sometimes inconvenient animals like bison, was part of a project of settler colonialism to tame a landscape that European settlers saw as being inhabited by unruly ecosystems, unruly animals, and unruly people, right? And so this idea of ridding the landscape of these inconvenient creatures, inconvenient ecosystems, and inconvenient indigenous people is part of the same project. So that's a big part of it. There's also something that I think is a little bit deeper and a little bit more psychological in a sense, which is that coyotes have often been seen as bad dogs, right? So dogs, you know, man's or people's best friend, you know, these animals that have joined with us in this process of symbiosis, of coevolution, of working together over the millennia in our, you know, 30, 40, maybe more thousand year relationship with dogs. Coyotes, I think by some people, are seen as the dog that didn't take that bargain, the dog that didn't participate in that agreement between humans and canines. And so whereas we pamper dogs, we punish coyotes. So I think it would be really great for us to get over this idea of coyotes and wolves as being the bad dogs that didn't go along with the bargain, and instead really just understanding them for what they are, which is wildlife species that are incredibly resilient, perform a lot of important functions, and have a value in them themselves, and actually pose relatively few risks.
That is such an interesting insight. I have to think about that. It totally makes so much sense thinking about human nature. Like, oh, they're the dogs that don't like me, so right. I don't like them either. Ha! Huh?
Absolutely.
So I've got to kill millions of them. Coyotes are at least native, and one of your most interesting chapters was about Florida. Like, Florida is like, it's insane. It's just insane because I think a lot of my listeners know a lot that the wildlife trade in exotic species that are not native, is like completely out of control. Like, just, it's huge, much huger than most sane people can possibly understand. And in Florida, they're basically, this happens everywhere, but particularly in Florida, because it's easier for a lot of animals to survive, they're basically out there in the real world. Like, so you're one of the first people I've heard who talk about that, who doesn't really talk about putting the genie back in the bottle, which probably isn't possible, but it's still a huge problem. So how do you sort out all those issues? You know, like the whole addiction to everybody has to be a native species. That's just not going to happen anymore. Like, it's, you know, it's a global economy for animals as well as us. But at the same time, there are invasive species that are really doing a lot of damage. How do you sort all of that out, particularly in the context of a place like Florida, where there are so many just animals escaping from crazy people's possession and inhabiting that state? I guess Florida might be underwater soon, so maybe that will solve the whole problem. But until that happens,
Florida geologically is a pretty recent thing, and it's probably going to be relatively short-lived. That's sort of a different issue. I mean, You know, I got to tell you that something I don't think I mentioned in the book is that I actually spent a significant portion of my childhood there in Florida.
You're a Florida man.
You know, I tell my son never to call me that.
I know other people who own that phrase.
If there's one thing my 11-year-old son knows, it's never to call me Florida. But he does it anyway, and we laugh about it. So I have some experience with that place, and there are a lot of folks there who are really, really passionate about wildlife and about ecosystems, particularly about the magnificent bird populations that they have there. It's just such a unique place in those ways, but it's also a place that has, in many ways, courted disaster and invited disaster in by its policies and by the way it's handled its relationships with its ecosystems and with exotic species. Florida has very lax laws for the importation of exotic species and also lax enforcement. And so the state has become kind of like an Ellis Island in a way for the importation of exotic species. And whereas, you know, I think that Ellis Island in New York has been a boon to American society and culture by bringing in these, you know, so many different people with so many different talents and experiences and backgrounds from around the world. I think in Florida, that experience with exotic species has been very different. And so what we have is a situation there in which the state has become sort of an entry point for potentially damaging exotic species from around the world. The case I try to make in the book is this, that urban ecosystems are novel ecosystems. They are new in world history. They are different from really anything that preceded them in some ways, fundamental ways. And we need to understand them as that. And because they are novel and different ecosystems, we shouldn't necessarily assume that because a creature is there that originated somewhere else, that's a bad thing, right? We shouldn't hold it against an animal or a plant for living in a city when it was imported there and maybe not be serving any negative function and maybe actually be serving a beneficial function in some ways or not expanding into the surrounding environment. And so we really need to start making a distinction between where a species comes from and what role it actually plays. So in Florida, we have examples of many species that live in urban environments that pose no problem, that actually maybe benefit the urban environment or the people take pleasure from, that are just fine there. But we also have examples of species that have been brought in that have expanded into surrounding ecosystems and are wreaking ecological havoc. And so I guess I'm making a pitch here for understanding urban ecosystems as novel ecosystems, for taking them on their own terms, and for thinking about the creatures that live in and around them in terms not just of where they come from, but of what they actually do. And to know what they actually do, we have to study that, we have to think hard about it, and then we have to develop strategies to address it.
That is such a great point. And I'm so glad you brought that point up about urban ecosystems are novel ecosystems. It's not something we've ever experienced before. I thought that was one of the most important points in the book. Like, it really made me think of it in a new way. We can't just think of, you know, what was native to the land I stand in on 100 years ago when the land I stand on is covered in asphalt and has buildings all around. It's really a completely different place. Another fascinating point, and so many fascinating points in this book. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about it, Peter. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a fun conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too.